Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I am Gary Gramling, and I am here, as always, with Andy Benoit. And I got to say, Andy, I'm looking at the rundown that our researcher, Jeff Irwin, sent along, and we have a show that is absolutely packed with excitement.
If you're into cornerback play, I'd say it's packed with excitement.
That is excitement in cornerbacks. That's our tagline for today's show. We are going to rank the top 15 cornerbacks in the NFL. That is a definitive ranking from the MMQB podcast. We will settle all future debates on that. We're also going to have a little talk, Eli versus Romo discussion, and we will take some of your questions in the mailbag as we always do. Beginning last week, we always do it, and we're going to do it again this week. Before we get to all that, we got some quick hitters from around the league. And we are going to start with the Raiders and a potential move to Las Vegas. For years and years, the hang-up with Vegas was the gambling aspect and the fact that, you know, you give your buddy $40 when he's going to Vegas and he will bet the over on the Southern Illinois-Toledo game, and it was going to corrupt any major professional sports team that would play in Las Vegas. But, you know, we reached a point where you can basically place any bet you want online through offshore sites. So I don't see any real reason that gambling should be a holdup, especially for the NFL.
Well, especially for the NFL, who now is in bed with DraftKings and FanDuel and these daily fantasy sports companies, which mm-hmm. are gambling one way or another. And that's a little bit of a separate discussion, but also not really. The whole idea of gambling has become so accepted because it's become universal that I understand the owners no longer are apprehensive. I get that. They're no longer apprehensive about Vegas. So I'm all for it. I think it's a great opportunity to expand the NFL into a region of the country that it wasn't before, that is actually the 30th biggest market in America. Yep. So it's got the size in and of itself to handle it. And then it has a lot of tourists coming in and out. So now you can spread the NFL to people from all over the country who would never see it, people from Iowa or the Dakotas or whoever goes to Vegas on a weekend. Mm-hmm. It's a great opportunity for all parties involved, in my estimation.
Yeah, and a quick aside, if you want to read about some of the, I guess, more hypocritical takes on the NFL's stances on gambling, Andrew Brandt wrote a great column probably mid-season last year. It is titled, "The NFL Has a Gambling Problem." Everyone knows how to Google, use your Bing, use your Ask Jeeves, go find that. That's a really good read. My question for you, Andy, is, geographically, would a Vegas team be the closest to you being in Boise?
I didn't want to bring that up because I didn't want to make it a selfish thing, but yes, it would be. And there are direct flights there. So,
nice.
Which we have direct flights to Seattle and Denver as well.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I did think about that. Although it's not like I get on a plane on Sundays during the season and just go catch a game. You know, that still takes time and it's not worth it to me. But in theory, yes, that would also bring in the much sought after Boise, Idaho, and Twin Falls, Idaho market.
There you go. There you go. Next quick hitter here. Tom Coughlin wants to come back. I guess my first question for you, before I share my opinion, do you think Coughlin should have been ousted last year? Or after last season, I should say.
Hold on. Can I post something first? Because I sent a group email to the MMQB and nobody replied to it except Matt Gagne, who didn't answer the question. He just asked something else. Didn't it look like on our homepage with that Coughlin article that he's like in the middle of a giant yawn on our photo that we used of him?
It did. When that email showed up, I laughed and I called out to Mark and Kalen. Mark Maravich, Kalen Kaler were sitting there. And I just said, I think Andy's right. And we all looked at it. Maravich didn't quite buy it. I think Kalen was on my side.
Well, you'd have to ask Maravich, what does he think Coughlin's doing then with his – what other – function would his mouth be serving at the angle and width that it is currently at in this photo?
He thought it was, you know, him doing some general, I don't know, jawing, talking, pump up talk with those very sleepy eyes. We got to find a clip of that though, because we got to settle that by the time you come out here for the retreat, because it's tearing the staff apart.
The weird thing is this is clearly a day game as well. If it were a night game, I'd get it because we're talking about a guy who's almost 70 years old. It's probably 9 o'clock on the East Coast. That's not early. But this was a day game. This was about a 1 o'clock game, judging by how the sun looked. Anyway, the Coughlin firing.
Yeah.
No, he probably didn't deserve, and it wasn't, you know, firing. I think he was fired, wasn't he? Or did his contract expire?
Officially, he resigned.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah. So, no, he probably didn't deserve it, but my guess is it's the same thing that happened in Tampa Bay, which is that a lot of teams were sniffing around Ben McAdoo.
Yeah.
And the Giants thought, we can't afford to lose this guy. I mean, imagine if the Giants had lost Ben McAdoo. Not only do you lose what you believe is a very good young coach, but you also have wasted the last couple of years putting in a very unique system that your guys have just now gotten used to, including your star quarterback who has about 5 years left in him.
Mm-hmm.
So it would not have behooved them at all to let McAdoo get away. And so I think they decide they have to cut bait a few years early with Coughlin.
Yeah. No, it was tough. It was a raw deal. I totally understand that angle, though, of wanting to retain McAdoo. Because I feel like they probably would have lost him. And then you got to hit the reset button with Eli again.
Gary, let's real quick understand, just so people know what makes McAdoo unique, because he does that Green Bay-type system.
Yeah.
And Green Bay in the passing game, the timing is very different mechanically than it is in a lot of schemes. So you hear about a three-step drop passing game, five-step drop. With the Giants, it's a two-step drop or four-step drop. And that might seem like a small difference, but that if you think about it, if you're doing two steps instead of three, then you've got to reverse all of your footwork, because otherwise you'd be throwing off a different foot. So it's a lot of different stuff has gone into adjusting Eli Manning to fit the scheme.
Mm-hmm.
You need very specific types of wide receivers for it. They don't have a very innovative running game, so I don't think that's much concern.
Yeah.
I think this is a case of, if you kept Coughlin, you run the risk of having to remake your quarterback at a stage of his career where that's really just not appropriate.
Yep. And Coughlin's, you know, he's 70 years old, or he's going to be 70 if you were to come back next year.
And 70 is not, I guess, you know, I made an age joke earlier, but 70 is not super old, I don't think, for the job. I mean, there's never been any indication that Coughlin's age was an issue in New York. Would you agree?
No, I absolutely agree with that. And by the way, he will be 70 on August 31st this year. I mean, the problem is, I hope someone gives him a shot. I hope he's back coaching again. It's just like, everyone wants continuity, especially with their coach and with their quarterback. And you're going to bring in a 70-year-old coach. At most, you're going to get, what, 10 years out of him in all likelihood?
Oh, at most. Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, the oldest coach I can remember, I think Marv Levy went into his mid-80s. I mean, yeah, I don't know if a 70-year-old coach has ever been hired by a new team, has he?
Yeah. I mean, that's a... That's a tough sell. I don't know. I don't know if he's getting back. I think he's going to have to settle for some sort of advisory role, which I think he'd have value in. I think what went wrong with the Giants last year was they had some issues with situational football, which is ultimately it's correctable. There were a handful of bad mistakes at the wrong times. And you know, these guys still played for him. They were shorthanded on defense, but you know, I don't think it was a problem with the system on either side of the ball. Yeah, I don't know. I think we've seen the last of Tom Coughlin as a head coach.
So then the next discussion becomes whether he's a Hall of Famer or not, and we can have that discussion. I feel like the dust needs to settle more on Coughlin in order to have that discussion.
Yep. Moving on to a guy who is about half of Tom Coughlin's age here. Dwight Freeney wants to come back after a nice little run with the Cardinals last year. What did you see from Freeney, and would you go ahead and add him if you were looking for some edge rushing help?
Yes, I would absolutely add him. If I have room for a rotational 20 snaps a game guy, I want Dwight Freeney on my team. There were times last season, in fact, you could argue more often than not, Freeney looked like the Dwight Freeney, for the most part, that we've come to know. Maybe not Dwight Freeney circa 2005 or something like that, but certainly Dwight Freeney circa 2010, 2011. He still has an excellent speed to power pass rush, meaning he gets off the line and then can bull rush you. His spin move hasn't lost a step. He knows how to do all these things. He's smarter than ever, in fact. And if he knows he's playing, not just if he's playing 20 snaps a game, but he knows he's playing that, then his energy and age become a borderline non-issue. So go back and ask Matt Khalil, who played against Freeney on Thursday night in the middle of the season, or I think it was early December that they played. Ask him if a team should sign Dwight Freeney, because that guy hasn't lost much of what he is, and you can get him now, I'm sure, at an extraordinary price.
Yeah, I'm really shocked he's still out there, considering, I mean, look, the time and time again, you see the way you win football games on defense is by getting pressure on the quarterback, and here's a guy who can do that. Is Buffalo an option? I mean, Shaq Lawson is now questionable for the start of the year. Do you see any chance of Freeney fitting in with a Rex Ryan defense?
That could be. It's the one concern with that is that Freeney would be asked to do a few things that he's never been asked to do before, a lot of zone blitz stuff. And he's not going to do it often, but it's something he'll have to learn. One reason Freeney might still be out there are some coaches who believe that with veterans like this, I remember this was the Steelers thinking with James Harrison a few years ago. Mm-hmm. When Harrison came back and he came back and took Jarvis Jones' job and held on to it midseason, and his contract was up and no one was sure if he was going to come back again, the Steelers' attitude was, we don't mind if he waits till September to decide, because he, at this age and stage of his career, he's only taking snaps from younger guys in practice anyway, and that's not productive for us. We're not going to put the mileage on him in practice, and we need to be training our other guys. So now Harrison wound up signing quicker than that. My guess is Tennessee probably wanted him when Dick LeBeau went there, so that the Steelers had to sign him. But my point is, coaches are willing to let older guys sit and wait because they know that they're not going to be practicing with them anyways.
Yeah.
Now, it's different with Freeney, though, because he's not going to return to the Cardinals. He's going to go to a different team. But there are a lot of teams that run a 4-3 like Freeney played in Indianapolis, just a cover two. Mm-hmm. And there are a handful of teams that run the type of 3-4 or hybrid scheme that Arizona ran. So I would look for him to go there. Buffalo, I don't know if they quite fall into either of those categories, though.
All right. I'm going to mix up this rundown on you, and since we were just talking about Buffalo, since I brought them up, Shaq Lawson, first-round pick, out 4 to 6 months after shoulder surgery, reportedly hurt it executing a swim move in practice. So the Bills, look, they're trying to build quickly here, especially on defense. Mario Williams is gone. Shaq Lawson was the presumed replacement. It looks like maybe Ike Mpali is the next man up on the edge there until Lawson is ready in maybe, I don't know, quarter mark of the season.
I think trouble. That's optimistic, by the way, here at the quarter mark.
And, I mean, you know, he's a rookie. He's never played in the league before. I mean, there are a lot of variables working against him here. But how much trouble are the Bills in as far as, I don't know, generating pressure?
Well, they can still manufacture it through scheme. So as long as they have the cornerbacks they do, and we're going to talk about some of these guys in our top 15 corners later, Stephon Gilmore, Ronald Darby, and even a very good nickel slot blitzer and cover artist in Nickel Roby, if they have those three guys plus flexible safeties who can play coverage, which they have because Corey Graham and Aaron Williams are both former corners, then I don't think this really hurts their pressure, so to speak. I mean, is Lawson a good, talented player? Yes. Would he have helped them in theory? Absolutely. But it's not going to change their scheme. They don't have a gaping hole to fill now. You said it. Next man up might be Enikampali, or it could be Manny Lawson, could be Lorenzo Alexander. I mean, it's going to be a rotation of guys. But all of them are going to be asked to do the same things that Lawson would have been asked to do, and perhaps some of them will be better at it because it's not a simple scheme there in Buffalo. And I think a rookie, and one we know about Lawson coming out, we both thought he's going to need some coaching early on. Mm-hmm. He's good. He'll need coaching. I'm not sure how much a rookie would have had a great impact to begin with anyway. Which is also why I'm not so sure he can just step in mid-season once his shoulder heals and be fine. I think we could be looking at what amounts to a lost rookie year for this guy. Yeah. I hope I'm wrong.
Yep. Sammy Watkins also having some trouble there, which is, I mean, that's real bad news for an offense that is pretty short on weapons in the passing game.
Yeah, they couldn't afford to lose Watkins. Now, he's expected back for camp, as I understand it. Is that correct?
They're hoping for training camp, although I saw another report today that was mentioning hopeful for the opener at this point.
Ooh, which is there's a difference between
a much
those
different
two.
Thing.
Yeah. The Watkins injury would be much bigger than the Lawson injury because that's a case where you can't just replace him. Even though the Bills are a fairly contained offense schematically because they play to Tyrod Taylor's strengths and hide his limitations, the more you play that way, the more you rely on individual talent to win in the passing game from your wide receivers. So losing Watkins would be a problem for this offense.
Yeah. It looks like
obviously. I mean, we're talking about losing your best wide receiver. That's always going to be a problem for an offense.
I mean, it looks like NFL Network is saying should be ready for training camp, but the Bills beat writers who are embedded with the team are saying that is more of a hope, and they are looking at more of a week one optimism for Sammy Watkins.
Those Bills beat writers do a good job, too. I would tend to believe them.
They do. They got a good group up there. And our last quick hitter here, Josh Norman, and obviously it is not news right now that he signed. The MMQB's Emily Kaplan spent time with him down there, and one thing I thought was an interesting takeaway from the piece was Norman implied that they had told him, well, you know, I'll read exactly what the passage is here. The trash talk of choice for Norman's wideout foes is to classify him as a, quote, good cover two corner. In Washington, Norman was told he would have more opportunity to play man-to-man. And this is Norman's quote. In Carolina, everything was defined. It was black and white and some gray. Here, everything is gray. It's more free. I cannot just be in a scheme, but be a football player. I have a little more freedom. The shackles have been broken off, and man, I'm going to show them something they've never seen before. Close quote. So, you know, I know... You have mentioned that Joe Barry down in Washington ran a very vanilla, straight-up zone scheme last year.
The most vanilla zone scheme in the NFL last year.
But was that – do you think there's any chance that was a function of the lack of talent they had in their secondary? And now that they have a Josh Norman – and look, this was also a selling point for Josh Norman because obviously this whole zone corner branding sticks in his craw a little bit, and I'm sure he – loved to hear that he was going to get a chance to play some man and then sort of prove himself as a true shutdown guy. But, I mean, do you see them showing a little more flexibility or do you think they were just sort of blowing steam to get Josh Norman to sign on the dotted line here?
My guess is it's somewhere in between. Of course they're blowing some kind of smoke to get him to come because that's what everybody does. It's just like whenever a new coach is hired – and they say, well, hey, coach, welcome to your first press conference. Hey, what's your philosophy? He says, well, I'm going to change it up. I'm going to add some new wrinkles. We're going to be aggressive. Every coach says it's the same kind of thing. You know, hey, Josh, we're going to play man-to-man. You're going to get a chance to shine. The reality is there's no evidence that that's how they'll play. Now, they might play that way, but there's no evidence that they will because Washington and Joe Barry, as I said, they were the most vanilla zone defense in the NFL last year, and that's not a slight. They needed to play that way. They'd been under Jim Haslett for the years before, and he was very complex, high-volume stuff, and it did not work for this group of players. So I get why they played that way. Typically, the better players you have, the simpler you can be. So I'm inclined to believe that they're going to stay vanilla and just account on their better players making plays, and maybe that's what they mean by – gray area is, hey, you've got the freedom to break on the ball. You've got the freedom to jump out of your zone if you read something versus Carolina. Maybe they didn't coach them that way. But if we're talking schemes, Washington versus Carolina, Carolina asked its corners to play man-to-man more than Washington asked its corners to play man-to-man. And Carolina last season had a much more diverse cover three foundation than did Washington.
All right. I guess we're just going to have to see what happens.
It's a wait and see, and I'll be eager to see because that will be revealing. They'll tell you a lot about how they feel. Now, if they want to play that way, I think they do have the guys to do it. If Norman is a decent man-to-man corner, which I think he would be decent at it at best, or actually at worst, he'd be decent. They've got Breland. They have Quentin Dunbar, who's a good boundary corner.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. We'll see. But keep in mind, you also have to hide your safeties a little bit if you're going to play certain coverages. And Cravens, their safety, is a hybrid linebacker. And D'Angelo Hall is an old man with a couple of torn Achilles to his name.
Mm-hmm. No, and look, they can always I think they might sprinkle some in early on and see how it works, sprinkle some man concepts in with Norman specifically, see how it goes, and they can always bail on it. I mean, what you know, if Josh Norman's being embarrassed out there, they can always just go back to a very straight-up zone scheme that would fit what he has done so far in his career.
Yeah, and it's not a hard scheme to teach in theory. Now, you do need to practice it so if you want to be unique and good at it, but this team did it last year. So I think you're right. If they do want to go man-to-man, they can use the zone as a safety net for them. And keep in mind, none of this stuff's black and white. Everything's gray because there are certain situations in every game that call for man coverage.
Yeah.
And the two most common ones for our listeners, just so they know, third down and short, pretty much anything like 5 yards or less will be man coverage. Some teams will play cover two to that, but most teams play man-to-man. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is if you blitz. And part of the reason that Washington was so vanilla is that they didn't blitz often. And the reason you play man-to-man in both those scenarios is the idea is to get the ball out of the hands quickly of the quarterback. So third and short or a blitz. So it's not like we're never going to see man coverage one way or the other here.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit later in our show, we are going to count down the MMQB podcast rankings of the top 15 cornerbacks. Is Josh Norman number one? He is not. But he is on the list, and we'll see where he falls.
I thought you were going to stay with that tease there. That was radio stuff.
We're going to take a very quick break here. We will be back in 30 seconds. On the SI Media Podcast, Richard Deitch welcomes five-time NBA All-Star and TNT broadcaster Chris Weber. Hear stories of Weber's incredible run with the Fab Five at Michigan, his career in the pros, and now a new life in broadcasting. That's the SI Media Podcast hosted by Richard Deitch. Find it at si.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and now Google Play Music. Yeah, I'm really surprised.
By the way, Chris Weber's done a really good job in these NBA playoffs.
He has. As I was reading that promo, only a five-time All-Star? That was surprising to me.
That seems low. Yeah, that does seem low.
It does.
Where do you think he was best? At what stage and team of his career?
Oh, definitely the Sacramento years. I mean, he was a more explosive athlete and all that during the Washington days, but that Rick Adelman system that had him working under the high post, he was a do-it-all guy, except for defense. Didn't do a whole lot of that, but yeah, he was a good player. We are going to talk some Eli versus Romo, and we still have the mailbag. We still have the cornerback rankings coming up a little later in the show. But before all that, I wanted to very briefly turn things a little bit bromantic in here. I've been doing this podcast with you, Andy, for a month or so now, and I genuinely love it. It has been one of the highlights of my week every time I come into the office. And I think last week was my favorite moment of podcasting with you so far, because you had I'm going to play it back right now. You had a mini freak out basically right after preaching that nobody freak out. And I'm going to quickly play the setup here. And by the way, Andy is going into, we were doing the running back rankings. We did the also receiving votes. And this starts with Andy highlighting a couple of guys that were in the also receiving votes. And this was a very even-keeled Andy Benoit right here.
I had Ivory at 13 and Bernard at 15. So I guess I feel they should have been on there, but I'm not. Again, we're having a football discussion here. I'm not going to send an angry tweet to you and Jeff Irwin over this one.
All right, and now I timed this. This upcoming clip was 31 seconds later. I have just revealed Ezekiel Elliott as the number 15 running back on our countdown, and this is Andy Benoit again, 31 seconds later.
And you must have put him way too high then. Where did you put him? You put him number 5, I'm looking. Did we? Oh, God, jeez, what is... We did 8 minutes on him last week. Are we going to do another 8 minutes on Ezekiel Elliott here, and you tell me why he's the fifth best running back in a league he's never played in? Oh.
I enjoyed that thoroughly as I was listening back to that as I mowed the lawn on Saturday. And I just
now that was a hot take, wasn't it? That could get me on a couple of certain television shows in the mid-afternoon.
There you go. You went zero to, Jim Harbaugh in 31 seconds there. And
I hadn't seen the list. I didn't know that. I mean, I thought about it later and thought of a bunch of other things to say to you and just didn't call you or text you because I've moved on. But, I mean, and the other one that bothered me, and he has a defense for it. I don't agree with it, but he has one. I'm going to read it.
Yep.
Is Jeff Irwin put Adrian Peterson at number 10 on his running backs. Jeff Irwin's excuse was Peterson's value is very volume-based, meaning he gets to run the ball a lot, so mm-hmm. he gets bigger numbers. Last season, he had a 13.5% more carries than Doug Martin, who had the second most in the league. Volume's not meaningless, that Irwin admits, but his yards per attempt ranked low. Arbitrarily makes a cutoff at 100 attempts. He's 15th in yards per attempt if you cut off guys at 100 attempts. And then he gets into advanced stats and says they seem to agree. I guess Pro Football Focus had him ranked 27th, which I'm sure they've heard from more than a few people about that. And Football Outsiders has him 17th in run DVOA. So that was Jeff Irwin's defense for putting Adrian Peterson low. I think this is a classic case of overthinking, and you have to understand with the running back. It's like we're going to talk about this with these corners, Gary. You have to look at what they're being asked to do.
Yeah.
And Peterson plays in a very rudimentary offense that's built entirely around him, mm-hmm. and he sees an 8 and 9 man box more than anybody in the league, and they still choose to run the ball with him, and it worked for Minnesota. So if you put Peterson behind – if you gave Peterson's Ezekiel Elliott's conditions this year and put him in Dallas with Dez Bryant and behind that O-line, he'd have 2,000 yards rushing. Anyway, that's the second rant on the whole topic.
No, that's, you know what, that's good. I'm glad Jeff got to get that out there. I mean, I disagree with his assessment, but I understand the logic behind it at least. I mean,
yeah,
again,
I'm the same way, and I'm grateful that there was some logic behind it. I'm looking at his cornerback list now, and I think he's certainly improved. There's one guy he got on here, and he's going to become our number 15 guy strictly off Jeff's vote because Jeff had him at number 7, it looks like.
Yep.
But other than that, you know, it's a better week for Irwin. Let's put it that way. He's turning it around a little bit here.
That's what you want to see from the young guys. You want to see improvement week to week. Jeff Irwin showing that early on here. We will get to the cornerback rankings, but first we're going to talk a little bit of Eli Manning versus Tony Romo. I don't know if this went big nationally. Boomer and Carton, again, New York bias. They are the WFAN morning show around here. I listen to exactly 8 minutes of them every morning as I drive to the train station. They had Joe Montana on. Montana said he would take Eli Manning over Tony Romo. I personally agree with that, but I will open that up to you first. I think they're both good players. I don't think there's a huge gap between them, but I would go with Eli both now and in the past. Andy, do you have anything you would like to share on this topic?
They're both kind of extreme, aren't they? They've had a lot of highs and a lot of lows.
Yeah.
And they seem to be as all quarterbacks are. So this is probably just a symptom of the fact that we see these guys, it seems like on Sunday Night Football every other week during the season, but they seem to be the reason their team wins and the reason their team loses. You talked about the problem the Giants had last year, and game management was what you brought up, and that was correct, and a lot of it was Eli's decision-making in the red zone. So I think they can both be bad. I think they're both very, very good overall, though.
Yeah.
And I think you can win a Super Bowl with either guy. We know you can with Eli. So I don't know. I flip-flop on these two. I have Eli number 9, Romo 10, or vice versa a lot of the time, I feel like. I think heading into the season, you have to put Eli ahead of Romo just because of where they're at in their respective careers mm-hmm. based on last season.
I feel like Eli has been relied on more heavily during his prime. That I feel like the Giants have relied on the passing game in general much more heavily than the Cowboys have. I mean, look, that's managing the running game is part of a quarterback's job and managing the team. But I feel like, yeah, I feel like the Giants have been much more reliant on Eli. And I also feel like that, I mean, there's always this funny perception of Eli, whether it's because of body language or I think he's kind of doing shtick. I mean, I don't think Eli's a grifter or anything, but, you know, I think he really plays up the sort of aw shucks, I'm just Eli type of thing, you know. But
yeah. It's funny how that body language didn't seem to matter once he won a Super Bowl with that body language.
That was a really big thing back in the mid-2000s here. Tiki Barber used to be just all over him with the body language, and you know, it was a weird time.
I get that it's important, but if a guy knows what he's doing, and players know who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
If a guy knows what he's doing, I mean, if Colin Kaepernick, for example, and I'm not trying to pick on him, but if he had that kind of body language, that'd be a real problem, because when he gets in the huddle, I'm sure he doesn't command it the way that Eli Manning commands it, because the guys haven't seen him have success with the plays he's about to call and practice before.
Yeah.
Not the way Eli does. I mean, if you have a command of the system, then I don't think your body language matters a whole lot, because you know what you're doing out there.
Yep. Now, I don't think his teammates have ever really had an issue with Eli and the body language stuff. You could say the same thing about, you know, if Colin Kaepernick went after his teammates like Tom Brady did or Peyton Manning did when a mistake was made, you know, you'd say the same type of thing, and you know, someone would probably punch him in the back of the head in the locker room, and that would be that. But, I mean,
you know, both of these quarterbacks have also done the things that make you good NFL quarterbacks in the modern era. And what I mean by that is they control the game at the line of scrimmage. People don't realize how much power Romo has and how good he's gotten in the pre-snap phase at the line of scrimmage. And Eli, he gets overshadowed because we think of – when we hear Manning, we think of Peyton Manning at the line of scrimmage. But Eli also plays that way and for the most part has been very good. I mean, I know all years – for example, he's in charge of the protections for New York, which is why they can play young rookies so often and along their offensive line, is because Manning says, you block him, you block him, you block him, here we go. And that's a different level of quarterbacking. Not every quarterback can do that. So they do all the things, all the little things that make for great quarterbacking. And they're also better throwers of the football, I think, than people realize.
Yeah.
Who do you take? In career-wise, you have to take Eli, right? Just because
yes.
If you have to pay attention to credentials at some point, and he's got more credentials than Romo.
Yeah, I think career-wise, you take Eli. Even looking back over the years, I think Eli could have executed what Romo did. And look, Romo could have executed what Eli did. I don't know if he would have had the same success. And I also always found it a little bit, coincidental, I guess, that, you know, Tony Romo always had this, you know, always a big game choker and
that, yeah, that wasn't true.
It wasn't true. What Eli tends to do, I shouldn't say often, but he does some really head scratching stuff, especially last year. And I'm thinking early last year, and that's probably sort of clouding my judgment a little bit. But, you know, in Dallas, where he threw the ball away and stopped the clock when they were trying to run clock late in the game off that play action. And you know, they went through that phase where for some reason they were throwing the ball to Preston Parker during the 2-minute drill when they needed points. You know, he does some sort of head-scratching stuff.
He does, and I think the perception comes – so on the Romo front, the reason he had the reputation as a big-game choker, which was totally invalid because – his quarterback rating in the fourth quarter for a while there, if it still isn't, it was for a while, was the best in NFL history.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the numbers didn't back it up, but he didn't hold the ball properly on a point after attempt in a big wild card game. And so that was the very first year he played. And so that set the narrative. And then from there, he had some mistakes in the fourth quarters of games, probably 4 or 5. They were all on national TV. I'm thinking of the Jets game, I remember in week 1 of in 2012, or 2011 rather, he had one against the Lions. I mean, there were a few that we all know about.
Mm-hmm.
So that amplified the narrative with Romo, but he doesn't fall for the trap coverages like he used to. He outgrew that. And then with Eli, I learned, Gary, from Ron Jaworski once explained, every quarterback's going to make you have to assume there's going to be two boneheaded decisions a game from the quarterback. And what what's really important is what happens on those boneheaded decisions. How do you manage them? Do they turn into incompletions? Or are they just missed opportunities? Or do they become turnovers or something even worse even? And I think Eli hasn't managed his boneheaded decisions well over the years at times. And so that augments it. So there's a little bit of a recklessness with both of these guys. That's true. But again, their positives so far outweigh their negatives. And their negatives have come with unusual spotlights cast upon them, which makes them look worse than they are.
Yeah. You think Hall of Fame for both?
I think for Eli, it's going to be a yes, because for one, he's still, keep in mind, he probably has 5 years left. I mean, he's 35, but he's never been hurt, and he's going to keep playing, and his numbers will eventually become Hall of Fame caliber. So people are going to look at his numbers, and then they're going to see two Super Bowls, and they're going to have to put him in the Hall of Fame. That's how the conversation will go at the table. I think Romo will be a different discussion, and I don't see Romo quite as a Hall of Famer. To me, he's going to be more in the Donovan McNabb camp, maybe even lower, because McNabb had playoff success.
Yep.
Romo hasn't really had that. So I don't think Romo will make the Hall of Fame. I think Manning will.
I agree entirely. It's a really boring debate then. I guess we didn't really debate anything. I agree with you, Andy.
But when you put the headline for this, just put the word elite. Like, you know, is Eli elite? Is Romo elite? And then everything we just said became controversial.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to take one more quick break. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Plenty of good stuff to come. No podcast covers the NBA Conference Finals like SI's Open Floor with Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver. Let's say you get up early for work and you can't stay up late to watch Steph Curry take on KD. No problem. Our guys are watching every minute and then producing a podcast that'll be ready for your commute in the morning. That's Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast. Find it at si.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and now Google Play Music. All right, before we jump into the cornerback rankings, the definitive cornerback rankings, we're going to go to the mailbag. And actually, before we even go into the mailbag, we are going to give a quick shout-out to Jason Jenks of the Seattle Times. We have cited the stat that Thomas Rawls did not willingly run out of bounds once last year on 107 touches. We cited that at least twice on the podcast. And both times we've been like, oh, yeah, we're not sure who came up with that. Well, Jason Jenks of the Seattle Times is the guy who charted all those plays and came up with that stat. It's a great stat. Really good piece on it, actually. You can go out and find it with the Google, with the search stuff. But, yeah, there you go. That's the answer to the mystery that's been haunting us. Jason Jenks of the Seattle Times. Great stat on Thomas Rawls. Thomas Rawls did not run out of bounds willingly on 107 touches in his rookie season.
Good. You did the right thing there. We did.
We kept on saying it. And yeah. So sorry, Jason, that we took so long to credit you for it. But the mailbag, we're going to open up the mailbag. As always, you can reach out to us through so many different avenues. You can, Andy and I are both on Facebook now. We have the public Facebook pages. You can get us there. You can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or gramling_si. You can send an email to talkback@themmqb.com. You can write a letter. You can. I'm on Snapchat. Andy, are you on Snapchat?
No, come on. No, God. I told you, I'm still embracing the Facebook endeavor.
Well, I'm new on Snapchat, and I'm actually not entirely sure what my screen name is. I think it's G Gramling. But yeah, I'm getting used to that whole thing. I'm going to try it, see what happens. Apparently, I have like, I don't know, 4 billion people on there or something like that. So, but yeah, send us questions, send us comments, send us criticisms, send us nice notes about how much you like us. It's all good. First question this week is actually sent to me via Facebook from Aaron Sampson. How does Marshawn Lynch deserve to be in the Hall when somebody like Ricky Waters can't even come close? We very briefly talked about Marshawn Lynch and his Hall of Fame credentials last week. I don't think either of us had a great answer, mostly because we don't have a definitive answer at this point. I still lean kind of yes. I'd be curious to see what happens to the Seattle offense over the next couple years. I think that's something that, for me, plays into it with Terrell Davis. I'm not so much down on Terrell Davis as a Hall of Famer, and I think Terrell Davis was a fantastic player. I'm not down on his Hall of Fame credentials so much because he had a short career. I'm more down because he had a short career, and then after he left, the Broncos didn't really miss a beat. They had Mike Anderson and Landis Gary and whoever else they plugged in there had a
ton
of success.
Well, they missed a little bit of a beat because they didn't win any Super Bowls after he left.
They didn't, but you know, Elway was also gone, and there were There were things going on there, and again, Mike Anderson was great. He was not quite Terrell Davis, but they were still very good after Terrell Davis left. And of course, with Marshawn, you're going to have Russell Wilson is not the quarterback he was 3 years ago. He's much better. They've invested in the offensive line, so it's not quite apples to oranges, but I'd be curious to see what happens to that running game now that Marshawn is gone. And as far as the Marshawn to Ricky Waters comparison, and I had responded to Aaron on Facebook, and he didn't quite buy the argument I was giving. He likes the total stats that Ricky Waters put up, and I don't quite buy it. I think Marshawn was putting up huge numbers in an offense where he was the focal point. I don't think that was ever quite the case with Ricky Waters, who was getting huge touches in offenses that were a little more well-rounded during his career.
I'm looking at Waters' numbers, his biggest years, because I think of him as a 49er, but that was only the first really 4 years of his career, and he didn't play as a rookie, so it really is only 3 years.
Yep.
His biggest numbers came in Philadelphia for 3 years and then Seattle for 4 years. He's at 10,600 yards rushing. That doesn't meet the minimum. I don't know what the lowest is in the NFL, but for this era of running backs, the lowest is for NFL Hall of Famers, I mean. This era of running backs, I think Jerome Bettis is kind of the Mendoza line for Hall of Fame running backs. And Bettis is at 13,600 yards with 91 touchdowns.
Yeah.
Now, and he was asked to do different things as well. You've got to look at, it's kind of like Marshawn Lynch. You've got to look at the types of yards Bettis was asked to get at times. So I don't know. I didn't watch Ricky Waters other than as a kid, so I guess I can't speak to it fully. But I'll admit I'd forgotten about him until I heard his name mentioned just now. So I don't think he's anywhere near the Hall of Fame discussion because I haven't heard sports writers talk about him for years.
Yeah. I mean, I think he deserves a little bit of discussion. I think he clearly comes up short. The other thing with Marshawn Lynch, I think you can make the argument that Marshawn Lynch is and hot take sirens are going to go off. I think you can make the argument that he's maybe the greatest postseason back of all time because, again, he was the focal point of that offense, and he put up monster numbers over 11 postseason games, 937 yards. He could have been the MVP of Super Bowl 49 if he gets one more carry in that game.
That's, you know, and I know we got to get to the next question. That's a good point you raised, though, is why do we begin these conversations with guys' total yardage from the regular season if indeed it's about winning, like people like to believe, and I think it is. Then we ought to start with the postseason numbers. You're right.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out in 5 years when people who know this stuff better than us start debating the Marshawn Lynch.
I don't know if they know it better.
Well,
so, I think there are quite a few issues with the Hall of Fame voting process now that people aren't quite aware of.
But we're contractually obligated to say that Peter King knows this stuff.
It's not an issue with our boss. No, yes. Correct. Peter King's fine. I think it's a flawed process. I mean, a beat writer from any NFL city can have a vote, but Chris Collinsworth doesn't have a vote. Or Greg Cosell, NFL Films, doesn't have a vote. There's a flaw in the system.
Yep. Question two here. This came via TalkBack. Someone emailed. This is Will. Just listen to the running back rankings. Don't understand how you left Eddie Lacy off your list. He played extremely well his first two seasons. Should be much better in 2016 once he's in better shape. 25, tons of upside. I don't see how Stewart, Rawls, Yeldon, Miller, Freeman, Martin are better players. And he goes on, 4.3 yards per carry, 29 total TDs and three.
No, I get it. I thought we'd have more gripes about Lacy. I don't think he was on any of our lists, was he? I don't think any three of us him on there.
I don't even think he was in I know you and I both jotted down some names of guys who didn't quite make our top 15.
He wasn't even on that. He probably didn't make our top 20. Maybe we underrated him a little bit. I look at the player as an entity, though, and Lacy is slow of foot. He does break tackles. I'll give him that. He's hard to bring down. When mm-hmm. he's good, he's easily top 15, top 12, maybe top 10. But we know the consistency issues. You know about the body. I think you can find other Lacys, Eddie Lacys, in the NFL. In fact, I think when they're in their three receiver sets, I think James Starks is a better fit for them still. Yeah. So I get it, Lacy. If someone put it on the list, I wouldn't mind, but he's not the style of running back that I value for today's game.
Yep, yep. Question three, another email. This is Todd Marvellis. I was surprised to hear Latavius Murray not mentioned at all in the list of top running backs. He's not a superstar, but he did top 1,000 yards in 2015 in his first year as a starter. Thought he would at least get a whisper in the honorable mentions. I actually did have Latavius Murray. I think he was like 18th or 19th if I had jotted down five or six guys outside my top 15. He wasn't – I remember hearing a lot about him during his redshirt year in Oakland and how he was – and again, you hear this about a lot of guys, but there's a lot of noise that he was really impressing with his work in practice. You know, he's a big guy. He's got a good all-around skill set. He wasn't as explosive as I was expecting last year. And I don't know exactly what I was expecting, but I wouldn't be – you know, if we did this again a year from now, I wouldn't be surprised if Murray was somewhere in the 12 to 15 range.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he was more explosive the first year we saw him, which was late in the season. He came along midway through. My issue with Murray, he is big, but he doesn't play big. He goes down quite easily, in fact.
Yeah.
He's not a tackle breaker. He's not a power runner by any means, and he's not necessarily quick. So to me, he's almost like a man without a country, so to speak, and he's very dependent on his blocking because of that. Now, when the blocking's there and he does roll downhill, he takes good angles, decisive angles to the ball, and you see some of the talent. But again, if we're looking at entities, I think the most important trait a running back can have to make him valuable is the ability to create yards, because just eating up yards, being good at running in the open field, using your blocks, well, that's just general running stuff. I mean, that's, in theory, that's what every professional runner should be able to do. So I like guys that can create, and I don't think Murray's a very good creator at this point. He could maybe become one. I'm not super optimistic. The Raiders must be, though, because they didn't draft the running back till the fifth round with DeAndre Washington.
Yep, yep. And last question we'll take this week. This is from Twitter, at Windy. WynDE. I don't know if that's like Wynn is a defensive end. WYNNDE. I'll just spell it out. We hear from him a lot.
Did you just make a Billy Wynn reference?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I don't know if that's like Wynn. Everybody knows Wynn, the defensive end, the journeyman, low draft pick, maybe even undrafted guy, Billy Wynn, who I think is a pretty good player, by the way. I think he has nice, quick hands.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. But his question was, if you guys were starting an NFL team, what schemes would you run and which players would you choose? I know if we're going to build a full roster, but...
We don't have time for that. Yeah. I can answer this one quickly because I used to ask this question of coaches all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit like asking someone, hey, do you believe in God? Describe God to me. That's a very broad question that's going to have a lot of different meaning to different people. What are your football philosophies? And so I never got good answers from it because it was just too broad. Mm-hmm. Most coaches say, I'll pick the players and figure the scheme out later. Almost all of them say that. And so I guess if I'm starting a team and picking players, I'll pick Andrew Luck, Odell Beckham, Le'Veon Bell. I mean, what are the rules for picking players, you know?
Yeah. My two favorite schemes, what I think I would do, if I would take Arizona's offense. I would just get a couple guys who can block up front, quarterback who's going to throw it deep. I want to base everything off deep passing. There's too many good things that can happen when you throw the ball deep. And just get me some guys who can run. Get me some of those little guys, those John Brown types that can get downfield. And defensively, I like what Carolina does with the interior pressure and then the linebackers who can sort of cover up for some of your deficiencies in the secondary, should you have any deficiencies in the secondary.
All right.
But yeah, it's like, you know, give me Luke Kuechly and then Von Miller. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough, it's a good question. I'm not getting on the question. I used to go to the combine and ask the question I'd ask every coach I met. It's just not an easy one to answer because you got to drill down a little bit more and then work from there.
Yeah. which we could do, but just not within the, I don't know, 5 minutes that we tried to do it in. Because we need to move on. Before we move on, again, one more time, send us questions, comments. We love getting your stuff. We legitimately love getting your stuff. I know I don't always say that with enthusiasm. But yes, we love getting your stuff. We love getting your feedback and your questions. We're on Facebook now. Get us on Twitter. Send an email to talkback@themmqb.com. If you send an email, put podcast in the subject line. That'll make Kaylin Kaler's life a little bit easier when she's sorting through everything. She knows what to forward to me and or Andy. But with that, we're going to move on. We're going to do the next in our series, off-season series of position rankings. We did running backs last week, should you want to go back to that show and listen to that. This week it is cornerbacks. In honor of, I don't really think it's in honor of anything. We talked some Josh Norman at the top, but we just thought it was a good week to rank the cornerbacks. As always, this is done AP poll style, which means there were votes by Andy, me, and by Jeff Irwin, our researcher. We counted Andy's votes double because he watches so much more film than Jeff and I do. And again, so if you got a first place vote, 15 points, second place vote, 14 points, going down to number 15, which is 1 point, and then we rank the composite top 15 here. We will once again start with others receiving votes. Jonathan Joseph, who actually would have been 17 because we had a tie for 15th, so technically we're going to count down 16 here. But Jonathan Joseph was the top others receiving votes, had 5 points. Sean Smith had 3. Janoris Jenkins, 2 points. Xavier Rhodes with 1 point. I was surprised Jonathan Joseph didn't get into our rankings. I think you and I both had him low, and then he didn't make Jeff's list, which bumped him out. But, you know, I don't know if you have any thoughts on
him. He's still viable. I went and actually looked at my notes on him because I was curious if he's starting to wash up or not. You'd think he would be. He's at that age.
Yep.
He's not. And what he's good at is quarters coverage, which is a matchup zone hybrid type of coverage where you start off in zone, but you've got man-to-man in a certain part of the field. And you've got to really understand football well to play quarters coverage. And I've always thought Joseph is one of the elite quarters coverage players in the NFL, and the Texans agree because they played more quarters than anybody last year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, I was kind of surprised he didn't get in here, but he's just been good for a long time.
And I agree. Say that he's very good on deep balls, too. Have you ever? I mean, teams don't throw deep successfully against him very often.
Yeah, yeah.
He should be on here. We're going to have to remove Irwin. I mean, it's just it's Irwin who cost him here. And then we're going to get to number 15. Remember earlier I said that one guy got really high vote, and that's how he got on the list? That's Irwin putting Darius Slay at number 7.
Yeah.
And that's how Slay's at 15. So, I think Slay's a fine player. I considered him, in fact. We have him tied with Delvin Bro as I steal Gary's play-by-play job here.
There you go.
I thought Slay was much better last season, and Detroit asked a lot more of him. They also play quarters coverage quite a bit there. I need to see one more year from both of those guys, though, Slay and Bro. And if they play like they did last year, then – and for Slay, it may have been 2 years ago. But if they play like they have recently, let's call it that, then I would put them top 10 next year, I would say.
Yeah, the you know, the analytics folks were very high on Darius Slay. I noticed that as I was looking around, sort of doing some quality control on my list. I had Darius Slay 17 on my personal list.
I'm being too hard on Irwin. I mean, to put Slay on your list is reasonable, very reasonable. 7 to me is a little bit high as all. Yeah. And so then we've got him at 15 as a group.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, Darius Slay tied with Delvin Bro. I like Delvin Bro, and I also find it kind of endearing that he just – I think it only happened twice. Maybe it happened 3 times last year.
I know what you're getting at. It happened twice, and it was in the same game against the Colts.
That's right. It was like he just falls down, and I don't –
He fell, yeah.
You know, that's an old it's an old trick. That old Michael Johnson and who's the Canadian sprinter back in the day? The guy who smoked him in the 150-meter race.
Oh, man, are you like asking me that?
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't begin to tell you.
Donovan Bailey.
Okay.
So the quick background, because clearly you didn't watch the 96 Olympics like I did, apparently.
No, I was 10.
Diamond Bailey Wood won the 100. He's a Canadian dude. Won the 100, blew everyone away. Michael Johnson was the U.S. star, won the 200. Nike set up this promotional race, 150 meters. And Donovan Bailey just blew Michael Johnson away. And Michael Johnson, with like 50 meters to go, you know, like grabs his hamstring and sort of limps to the finish as like a sort of, you know, like, oh, you know, I got hurt. That's why that's a. Yeah. So, anyways, that's my long roundabout explanation of Delvin Bro. Like, I just kind of wonder if it's like, oh, crap, T.Y. Hilton is blowing by me. I'm just going to fall down and just say I tripped instead of just.
Well, if he did, it worked for him. You know, on that note, and then we'll move on to 14. Mm-hmm. Remember Ashley Ambrose? He was a quarter for the Bengals. I believe it's him. If it's not him, I deeply apologize because this guy's about to get thrown under a bus. But he's an assistant coach at the University of Idaho now, and I heard that he's taught his corners or safeties. He teaches one or the other position, but he's taught him that if you get beat deep and you've just clearly given up the touchdown after the play, put your arms up and turn and look at the cornerback next to you, because then it'll look like a blown coverage and nobody's going to blame anybody in the secondary because they won't know who to blame.
That's awesome. And look, that's really
good
advice.
He teaches that. That's how he teaches it.
There's nothing – I mean, look, there's nothing more humiliating than getting blown by and trying to chase someone down who you know you're just not going to catch. So I got no problem with that.
Yeah. To be fair, though, Delvin Bro did not get beat often last year. He played man-to-man a lot, and he was very good. And if he plays like he did this next year, if he plays like that again, he'll be top 10 easily.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the tie for 15. We had Delvin Bro and Darius Slay, 9 points apiece. Coming in 14 with 12 points, Ronald Darby, who I did not rank, but again, he was just off my list. You had him 14. Irwin had him 8. And I like Ronald Darby, but you like him more, so I'll let you talk about Ronald Darby here.
Well, Buffalo asked him to play a lot of solo matchup coverage on the perimeter, and I thought he handled it very well. I think he has a good sense for the ball's arrival, natural feel for that. Mm-hmm. There's a physicality to him in a good way. He became a little bit up and down as the season wore on, but that's to be expected of any cornerback who has a lot of responsibility shoveled onto him. So I think Ronald Darby is a tremendous player, and I think the Bills on a 1 to 10 for excitement, they ought to be about a 9.5 for this draft pick that they took in the second round last year.
Yeah. I mean, and he's the only second-year guy on this list, I believe.
No, we got one more, because the guy that I kept debating with Darby last year is who gets my Rookie of the Year vote is the one who's right ahead of him on our list and was on my list, too, I think.
Marcus Peters
at 13.
Well, that was – I mean, his name was right there on top of him. Yeah, so 13th, we have Marcus Peters with 13 points, and you can dive into Peters.
Well, similar to Darby, he's not quite as physical. He's a little bit more finesse style. I think he'll be better in off coverage than Darby will be, but I think Darby can be a better press guy. They're both tremendous solo matchup one-on-one cover guys. Where Peterson's good, he has a really good feel for when the ball's arriving and angles. He needs to become a little bit more consistent in that. There were times last year where I felt he played the angle at the top of the route incorrectly. But again, we're talking a rookie being asked to do a lot of things. Buffalo and Kansas City are both high-pressure defenses with matchup man-to-man principles more often than not on the back end. Both of these guys played left corner along the boundary. And the question becomes whether one of them can start traveling with number one wide receivers. And if that's going to happen, it'll be Peters this year because Sean Smith is gone. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be room for that. I don't think they'll do that because my guess is they'll just play their guys on the same side. But that's the level of cover corner we're talking about here, guys that can match up against number one receivers.
Yeah. And we'll find out a lot about Peters this year. I just get the sense when I watch Peters, I get the sense that he thinks he is going to catch every ball thrown out there.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. So Peters is 13. At number 12, we had the veteran Vontae Davis with 16 points. Just backtracking really quick. Peters was 13 on Andy's list, 15 on my list, 10 on Jeff's list. Now Vontae Davis, 11 on Andy's list, 10 on my list, and not ranked on Irwin's list. But he picked up enough points, coming 12th here on our rankings, 16 points. Yeah, he banged up a little bit 2 years ago, if I remember correctly.
It's been a lot of years. He's one of those guys that's fighting injuries, it seems like, once a month at least.
Yeah, he. I remember him being absolutely exceptional in the 2014 postseason when they went to Denver and upset the Broncos. Yeah, I mean, he can look when he's healthy. Vontae Davis can still play.
Well, and so here's where we get into the difference. So the theme so far, we've talked about guys that can play quarters coverage, which is matchup man principles on the perimeter. The Colts play that a ton as well. That's one of their foundations, that or man-to-man. And the only reason they play that way, and you have to play that way to do some of the blitzes that they do. That's just the structure and the foundation of their defense. Remember, Chuck Pagano is from Baltimore, yep. And they're going to go that direction even more this year. But the only way you can get away and playing that way is if you've got a cornerback you trust, and Davis is one they clearly trust. He's a lot like Peters, except that he's more willing and able to tackle. The only concern with Davis is that I think they wanted him to become a every man, travel with the number one receiver, go into the slot type of guy, and he's never become that. He's really a true boundary corner, likes to play on the right side of the defense, so he's not particularly versatile. And as we're going to see, we've had a lot of cover corners who play in a matchup scheme so far, and when we get to the first or the top half of this list, we're going to have just a lot of pure cover corners.
Yeah,
and that's going to be the difference of these guys.
And Dave's only missed one game over the last 3 years here. That is surprising.
Is that true? That's surprising. Well, yeah. He's been banged up.
He's always on the injury report.
That's a hat off to him, then. We deserve it. We ought to take our hats off because he's been less than 100% for more than one game, I guarantee.
There you go. Coming in number 11, Malcolm Butler, 19 points. It's ridiculous to look back at it now, but I was kind of down on Butler after the opener last year because Antonio Brown, of all people, spun him around a couple times and torched him. But that's kind of like, you know, I don't know, it's kind of like criticizing a guy for not catching Ted Ginn from behind or something like that. He was good, and he shadowed number ones. I mean, you know, the guy was... I can't believe how good he is, I guess is what it comes down to. I had him 7, you had him 12, and Irwin had him 14. So yeah. I was a little higher on him. But yeah, I think he had a lot of tough matchups last year. I thought he was great against Odell Beckham in that game.
He was. He won that battle against Beckham. I mean, Beckham got a big touchdown on the first throw to him early in the game, but after that, it was pretty much a draw. And see, Gary, I felt different about the Antonio Brown game in week 1. I know Brown on paper, quote unquote, lit him up. But what I saw was a defense that had just lost its corners after winning the Super Bowl, lost Revis and lost everybody else, and went into week 1 deciding to put this undrafted guy on the league's best wide receiver with no safety help and just say, you've got him, shadow him all game long. How good and how impressive must Beckham have been during training camp in the offseason to draw that kind of, or not Beckham, excuse
Butler.
Me, Butler. How good and impressive was he in training camp in the offseason to draw that kind of assignment going into week 1? And they stuck with it. He would often travel with the best quick receiver on the team. So the smaller guys, Landry, Beckham's a smaller guy for the Giants. Brown was their smaller quick receiver. A lot of those times that's the number one receiver. He went into the slot as well. I thought he was a really good player for them last season. And if he is what he appears to be, then they can continue being a man-to-man based defense there in New England.
Yep. And look, that's why I had him higher than most of us. I just thought he had so many tough matchups last year, and he just never – again, I think Brown got him pretty good. A couple of really tough plays. There's one where Brown sort of reached over his head on a ball that probably should have been intercepted. That was just an exceptional play. But yeah, I think Brown sort of, you know, Antonio Brown just sort of loses people. I think he's really good at sort of using cues against defensive backs and just sort of spun around.
Brown's the hardest individual cover in the NFL, in my opinion. I think Beckham's number two, and maybe soon he'll catch Brown.
Yep.
But Brown's the hardest guy in the league to just match up and play on an island, which, again, I say the fact that they asked Butler to do that, because if I know that, Bill Belichick knows Antonio Brown's hard as well.
Yeah.
To ask Butler is quite impressive. The only other time I can remember him really getting beat was I think they played Jacksonville in week 5, and I remember he gambled on a ball from the slot, and he just lost the gamble, and that happens sometimes.
Yep.
But, no, I'm with you. I actually like your ranking of Butler better than my ranking of Butler.
Well, there you go. Now we're getting somewhere. This next guy, you're actually going to have to take yourself. Number 10, we have Joe Hayden with 20 points. Only appeared on Andy's rankings. I actually didn't even have Joe Hayden in my top 20 just based on last year, but I would like to hear the case for Joe Hayden, who you had ranked 6th.
Well, because I'm looking at the aggregate with him. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. He's had injuries, and he hasn't been as good the past year, maybe even year and a half. And so I never know when the breakoff is. Do we count Joe Hayden of 5 years ago? Do we count Joe Hayden only of last year? I don't know. But Joe Hayden has been so good for most of his career.
Yeah.
Yeah, a true number one man-to-man cover corner. They could not have played the schemes in Cleveland they've played without him because they rely so much on that man-to-man. So I just thought I'm giving Joe Hayden the benefit of the doubt because he's not old either. Joe Hayden's not washing up. He just needs to stay healthy.
Yep. Yep. No, that's fair enough.
Thought Joe base. Hayden's 27, by the way. He's really, he's right in his prime.
Quick aside on Joe Hayden. This is something Emily Kaplan mentioned. Joe Hayden is like the mayor of the NFL. Like everyone across the league seems to love Joe Hayden. They just sort of like gravitate to him. He just seems like a dude people want to hang out with.
You know who was like that in the NBA, I remember? He was not Joe Hayden's level. I believe he was from Georgia Tech. Jarrett Jack, the point guard.
Oh, yeah? I can see that.
Yeah, he was like the most popular guy in the NBA.
Back in the day, my oldest brother used to run FHM magazine when it was here in the U.S., and they would do a lot of, you know, around the Super Bowl, they'd do like their big Super Bowl party, and players would come out. And he said the one guy who, again, like when he walked into the party, like everyone, every NFL player like gravitated to him and just wanted to hang out with him was Warrick Dunn was always the guy who everyone just wanted to be around, be buddies with.
Yeah.
But, so yeah.
Well, now I wish I had Hayden higher.
There you go. So Joe Hayden seems like a likable dude. Hopefully he stays healthy, and hopefully he justifies the ranking here at number 10 in the cornerback countdown. Number 9, we have Jason Verrett, which I'm also actually going to hand off to you because I know you are a big Verrett fan, even before we revealed our ballots here. You had him 7, I had him 8, and Irwin had him not ranked.
Well,
which is just going to make you furious.
Verrett, I don't know if he got beat last year, like substantially beat. I can't remember a time.
Yeah.
And he's a boundary corner, kind of a pure man-to-man guy. I think he's equipped to play zone because he's good in short area. He can change directions, which I would imagine means that he could break on a ball out of a back pedal. But where he's been real good and where San Diego's used him is as man-to-man, and they're building around him, I think, because they went out and got Casey Hayward, who's another guy capable of playing man-to-man, and they have Brandon Flowers still, as we've talked about. So I think Verrett, he goes unnoticed because of the defense he plays in. He played on an unsuccessful team this year. But Verrett, I mean, he lined up and didn't get beat all season long. I don't know what else there is to say about him.
Yeah. I would like to see him tested a little bit more. I think I would love to see what he and Amari Cooper, if they are going to be matched up against each other over the next 2 or 3 years here. I think that'll be one to watch out on the West Coast. But, you know, teams didn't throw on San Diego a lot, and the other side of the field was often inviting. When Antonio Brown came to town, it was Michael Vick under center. So they were, you know, Steelers were basically playing the Wildcat for however many snaps they had that night.
Yeah, and Cooper, they had a lot of battles with Cooper this year because I just searched his name in my Chargers notes to see if I had anything on who won that between Verrett and Cooper. And Cooper's name came up 15 or 19 times. Whoa. That's a lot for a guy who's not on the Chargers.
Yep. Yes.
Cooper got him a few times, it looks like, here too.
Yeah.
He did get him a few times, although some of these it looks like they were a function of beating the scheme as well. You got to keep in mind, and this is why I don't know how these advanced stats do it. Just because a corner's in the picture doesn't necessarily mean he got beat.
Yeah.
Because the schemes call for you to play a certain type of technique, and you have to play that technique. Otherwise, the scheme doesn't work. And offenses know which plays beat your scheme, and if they call one of those plays and execute it well, you might be within 5 yards of the guy, but your body's going to be angled the wrong way. And that's not getting beat. That doesn't count. So Cooper had some big plays against them, 45 yards, but that was against a cover three beater where they wound up going against the safety. He had a 52-yarder on a wide receiver screen. You know, I wonder what Jason Verrett's numbers are, the more I think about it. I wonder how he looks in advanced metrics. Do you know? Yeah, I'm guessing ought to have Jeff. Well, Irwin, he must not look very good because Jeff Irwin didn't put him on his list. And Irwin clearly goes by advanced metrics.
I am sorry that my bemuse, was because I'm in the middle of typing to see where he comes in here. He was high. He was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He was – Pro Football Focus had him 6th, and they actually had him 5th because they ranked Tyrann Mathieu with the corners, which, by the way, we did not. We did not rank Tyrann Mathieu or Byron Jones down in Dallas. We put them with the safeties instead of the corners, so you won't see either on this list. But yeah, they had they.
That's not bad. You know, those Pro Football Focus guys are on top of it. Maybe I need to change my tune.
There you go. So yeah, Jason Verrett, I'd like to see a little bit more. I'd like to see him get tested a little bit more this year, and certainly he has the, you know, whatever. I had him 8th. You had him 7th. So we have a pretty similar assessment of him. We had a tie for 7th place here with 28 points between Aqib Talib and Desmond Trufant. I wonder about Trufant's ceiling just because he's not a big guy. He's not a small guy, but what, he probably goes 5'11", something like that. He's not a classic Dan Quinn corner, and I wonder if we've sort of seen as much as we will see from him in that scheme, assuming Dan Quinn is going to be there for a longish haul.
Well, Dan Quinn doesn't feel that way. He loves him, and I talked to him at length about Trufant at the Senior Bowl, actually, because I asked him what you just said. I said, you know, does some guys transcend the body type, the stereotype, if you will, of what you need in a corner in your scheme? Because we think of Richard Sherman and Brandon Browner and these long press corners, and that's not the way Trufant is built. And Dan Quinn made an interesting point. He said, well, yes, of course he transcends it, but what they also value in the scheme as much as length, if not more, is ball tracking ability.
Yeah.
And so you've got to – and Trufant's got that. Now, he hasn't made a lot of interceptions, but he also hasn't been targeted a whole lot either. So
yeah.
I like Trufant. I would be interested to see if he ever becomes a slot guy. I don't think they're going to want to use him that way.
Mm-hmm.
And Seattle tended to keep its – they like to specialize the slot guy there. They didn't move a starter from the outside to the slot very often. So he's probably a boundary corner for them. But, I mean, I watched every snap on film last year of him, and he hardly ever got targeted or beat.
6 feet tall. I actually didn't realize he was that tall. Shortish arms, 31 1/4. But that's a really interesting point with the ball tracking, which is something that is pretty underrated with these guys. You had Trufant 9, I had him 9, Irwin had him 9, everyone had him 9, and he ended up 7 on the list because of the various shuffling.
And then you said shortish arms, which is ironic because the guy right ahead of Trufant is, well, I don't want to reveal it, but the guy he's tied with is another long-armed guy, Aqib Talib.
There you go. You can reveal it. We're there.
Stephon Gilmore is going to be number 6, and Gilmore and Talib are two of the longest-armed corners in the NFL. And they're different styles of corner. Gilmore is going to out-physical you, and Talib is going to outmaneuver you would be really the phrase, because he's not a quick twitch guy necessarily. In fact, he lacks quick twitch. We saw that when he had to go against T.Y. Hilton at times.
Yep.
But he understands angles to the ball as well as any perimeter corner, maybe even just any cornerback, period. So he's what they would call a playmaker. And if you put Talib opposite Chris Harris, who's a true kind of just a stopper guy, then you've got a really good dynamic combination there, and you can do a lot of things schematically.
Yeah. So, again, Talib is tied with Desmond Trufant at 7. He was 10 for Andy. He was 11 for me. He was 5 for Irwin. And then we had Stephon Gilmore. Andy had him 8. I had him 6. And Irwin had him 12. I wish Gilmore would just, you know, stay healthy, stay on the field. That would be nice. I'd love to see what, you know, Dennis Thurman and Rex could do with him up in Buffalo over a full season.
Well, I think originally they were going to make him their Revis.
Yeah.
But Darby has turned out to be so good that I don't think you want to travel the guys around. I don't think you want to have Gilmore and Darby switching sides of the field because they just were both so good in their respective positions staying at the same side last year. Gilmore plays on the right, Darby on the left. So I think they feel he's a Revis caliber, but they might not use him that way now because they got lucky and found another really good corner.
Yep. Yes, they did.
Not lucky. I guess they scouted him, right? That's what our buddy Doug Whaley would say.
They didn't pick him out of a hat. So Stephon Gilmore was 6. We had a big jump here in point value, so a little bit of a gap here as we go to 5, and Darrell Revis was 5 with 45 points. You had him 5. I had him 5. Irwin had him 4. For me, it just comes down to, can Revis stay healthy, close to 100% healthy over the course of an entire season? I think he was banged up last year, and I think it really started to show. And I think when you get to be of a certain age, you know, he's 31 in July. I don't know if you can see sustained excellence from Darrell Revis over the course of a season anymore at this point in his career.
You know, he hasn't been a guy who relies on being a better athlete than people. He's always been a smarter player. So I think he's equipped to play well into his mid-30s at least.
Yeah.
Now, he slowed down or just he wasn't as good in the second half of last season as he was in the first half. Where he gets in trouble, if he's to continue playing at a high level, his coverage lapses come usually when he's in some kind of outside technique and he's in a squat position eyeing the quarterback.
Yeah.
So when he's not playing his man-to-man approach and he's looking at the ball more, that's not his strength, and that's where he could become susceptible to in-breaking routes or double moves or the type of things that happen when you attack a squat cornerback.
Mm-hmm.
But Revis still goes into the slot with guys at times if they're in man coverage, not zone, but in man. Guys don't want to play against him because he has such a good feel for route angles. He'll cut your route off and just run to the place you were trying to run to.
Yeah.
And his ball skills are pretty good. So yep. I wouldn't worry about Revis. He'd had a bad end of the year by his standards, but we're talking 6 or 7 games, which don't outweigh 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I just think going forward, I think he's going to – I mean, look, everyone loses a step in their 30s regardless, but I think when you're playing hurt more often than you're used to playing hurt, I think it sort of starts to pile up on you. Which is, and again, where we had him in the exact same spot. We both had him 5th, so I guess we have similar assessments. But
I think we need to put, I agree with what you said, but for the discussion's sake, I think we need to put a moratorium on talking about guys staying healthy because we've mentioned that with like 6 or 7 guys now, and I never know how to evaluate that when watching film. I think if you're out on the field, you got to be evaluated like you're out on the field, you know? And last week, we had that issue with running backs as well. So much of the battle is just staying healthy in the NFL, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think the nagging stuff piles up once you get into your 30s. I think you can't bounce back week to week like you could when you were, you know, in your mid-20s.
Oh, good. Well, I turned 30 in a few weeks, so thanks.
There you go. I'm 37, and I can barely move. I just stay in this swivel chair and sort of push myself across the office back and forth. Because I'm very, very tired. So Revis was 5. Just ahead of him with 46 points, Josh Norman at number 4. We discussed him earlier in the show. If you want to go back and backtrack
I think we all are clear on Norman at this point.
So yeah, I think he's going to play some more man this year. Andy is suspect of that thought, but we're going to find out. We're going to see what Josh Norman can do. I just want to make one more point on Josh Norman. He's the one guy that I watch when I'm watching Panthers games. There are so many times where I think, oh, Norman got beat. And he tracks the ball so well and he times his leaps. He high points the ball so well that it looks like he's beaten. It's like, oh, no, he broke it up.
Yeah.
He just lives on the edge like that.
I will say this, the game he was most known for last year, the Beckham game, Beckham beat him badly several times,
yeah,
and for a variety of reasons, the ball was not complete. Some of it was on Beckham, some was on the pass protection, whatever. But watching the Beckham beat him badly on film several times last year. So that matchup was not as one-sided for Norman as people think it was.
Yeah, yeah.
He won the matchup, though, because Beckham chose to lose it by acting like a moron that day. But it'll be fun to watch him go. I bet you they go after Norman early on when Washington plays the Giants this year.
Yeah. And look, we're going to see it twice a year for the next couple years here. It's going to be some good TV. Number three, 54 points. We had another sort of jump up here. We actually, the three of us had the same top three, just in different order, but we had the same guys in the top three. Coming in third in our poll, Chris Harris with 54 points. You had him two, I had him three, Erwin had him three.
Yeah, do you know what I did last week?
What's that?
I flew to Bixby, Oklahoma, and I went up against Chris Harris one-on-one.
Oh, yeah?
You don't know that? Has that not come up in like one of the editors' meetings? There's going to be a big article and a video about it soon.
No, what are you getting at?
What do you mean, what am I getting at? I went to Bixby, Oklahoma,
yeah,
which is where Chris Harris is from, and I played him one-on-one. I was wide receiver. He was corner. We did about 20 snaps. And he outplayed me.
You played it? Wait, you lined up like in football against him?
Yeah, in football. I had cleats. I bought a ball. I bought gloves. I motioned into the slot to get him to get, you know, back off on his press coverage a few times, which I found to be my best tactic.
Are you talking about Genesis? A little Sega Genesis?
No. Ask John DePietro, the video guy. You need to talk to Mark Moravec. This ought to have been a discussion. I just played Josh Norman last week, and my body is just now, or not Josh Norman, Chris Harris.
Yeah.
And my body is just now recovering.
That's insane.
He only put me on the ground once, and he called pass interference on it, which I think he was being nice.
So
he also said he went about, well, I don't want to give away the article.
There you go.
But suffice it to say, I went all out. I went 100%, which is about 50% more than I've gone at any stage in the last 10 or 12 years.
Yeah.
And Harris went less than that. He went, yeah. it was a competitive game, so to speak.
Nice. That's phenomenal. That's so good.
But
I
you know,
I didn't know that.
I got him at number two because for going against him, I went through my film notes. I was going to find all his bad plays so I could bring him up and try to reenact him when I played against him.
Yeah.
And like, he didn't have any last year. Like, it was unbelievable how good he was. I went and watched every quote-unquote bad play because Jeff Irwin actually helped me. He went through and tracked them all for me on Game Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And there were like four or five that you could call bad plays, and none of them were like bad cornerback, and they just were bad outcomes.
Yeah.
Chris Harris is a really good player.
Man, that is really cool. I was waiting for the punchline throughout that entire story because I had no idea about that.
That's how my friends have reacted too. I can't believe that this hasn't been brought up at some point. This is going to be on the website within like a week, I would guess.
Well, there you go.
Maybe 2 weeks. Maybe 2 weeks now.
Apparently, I'm a mere reader of the website now. No one tells me these things. So I'll keep an eye out for it. No, that's really good. I don't know. Anything else to add on Chris Harris?
No, that's about, I mean, yes, but I want to save
something
for the video.
Yeah. All right. Number two, 55 points. Edging out Chris Harris here was Richard Sherman. Third on Benoit's list, second on mine, and first for Erwin. One first place vote. Do you penalize him for playing a little more zone than the other guys?
No,
the top,
because
five,
I think people can tell who's going to be number one. It's going to be Patrick Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And Peterson and Sherman have barbed before over Sherman. Well, Sherman doesn't play man coverage. He can't do what I do, says Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Peterson can't do what Sherman does either. He can't play off man and zone coverage very well. And Sherman's the best in the league at it. So we're talking about the best off coverage or best zone corner in the NFL who plays in the league's best zone defense. And when he's been asked to play man-to-man, while he's not as good at it, he's still well above average.
Yeah.
And he even did it in the slot at times last year. The only times where Sherman gets in trouble, he can be a little bit vulnerable on redirection routes at the mid-level. So think of a guy slanting inside and then breaking back outside 10 yards off the ball, those Demaryius Thomas type routes.
Yep.
That's not a glaring weakness to have if you're an NFL cornerback, though.
And as Andy said, number one, Patrick Peterson, two first-place votes from me and from Andy, and he got a second-place vote from Jeff Irwin. The slimmed-down Patrick Peterson, even better last year. I mean, he was exceptional last year.
He was. He had a tough playoff game. I'm trying to remember, was it the Green Bay game or was it the Carolina? I think it was the Carolina game, wasn't it? Where everybody had a tough game.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, they imploded entirely in that game.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point to talk about, you almost have to find the negatives because what are we going to sit here and say? Hey, Patrick Peterson's really good. He's quick. He's physical. He's smart. I mean, yes, we know that. He's the best pure man-to-man cornerback in the NFL right now. And he plays in a scheme that requires that, too. They need him to be that in order for them to be what they are in Arizona.
Well, I remember when he was coming out in the draft a couple years ago, there was all the talk was, you know, was he going to be too overgrown? Was he going to have to go to safety? And clearly he is not, at least not anytime in the next 8 years or so.
Well, and even then, we just say, you know, he's not a good space player. He doesn't have spatial reasoning. He has to get up in your face and play you.
Yep.
So he would not make a good safety in the NFL.
Yep. Well, there you go.
But he's a good corner. He's a very good corner. We think he's the best in the league, in fact.
There you go. Patrick Peterson, our number one on our, again, definitive ranking of the NFL cornerbacks. We'll be back next week with some sort of offensive position. We'll probably just alternate offense defense as we go forward here. Thanks to Jeff Irwin for providing all the research throughout the show and for his votes, and he'll keep his vote. We won't let Andy strip him of his vote in the player rankings polls. Thank you, as always, to Alex Abnos, who will be editing this for us. And most of all, thank you to everyone out there for listening. You are the best. If you haven't already, please subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. And if you are on iTunes, leave a nice review for us, or at the very least, leave a lukewarm review for us. But that's it. That's the MMQB podcast. We will see you next week. I was Gary Gramling. He was Andy Benoit. Andy, do you have anything else?
No, I am eager to do next week, though.
All right. Let's do it. Have a great one.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.